Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky. And today we have a very, very interesting person, Dr. David Fox. And David is a forensic and clinical psychologist in Beverly Hills. And he actually gives shiurim in Gemara and Halacha at the Kollel of Los Angeles and trained as a dayan with the Rabbanut Yerushalayim. Dr. Fox, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be part of this.
Great. Thank you so much. I know that you participated with the people in the listening audience. We at the Orthodox Union, with our wonderful magazine, The Jewish Action, in the edition, which is the spring edition 2012, ask a series of questions. And we posed them to distinguished panelists all over the country. And Dr. Fox was kind enough to participate. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, what he said in the article and maybe really try to delve into it just a little bit more. So the question that was actually asked, you actually responded to two. We'll take one. Maybe we'll get to the other. I'm not sure if we can. But the question was, we all know of the dangers of allowing children to have free access to the internet. What are the more subtle challenges that technology poses for the from home? And in your response, you talked about something you called, which I thought was really interesting, called close encounters. But what we have today is closed encounters. So what did you mean by that?
I tend to pun quite a lot.
I noticed
and
that,
I was,
right.
I was making that association from the old movie Closed Encounters to Closed Encounters. But the serious threat beneath the joke was that the research is showing that we cannot have virtual friendships, which means that it's possible to a degree with more sophisticated minds that we can use technology, we can use the computer, the internet, to be a virtual teacher or professor, and there's learning that can take place to a degree, although we might want to talk about how that affects brain wiring. But with regard to the use of Facebook and other social networking, what we're finding is that the substituting of quote-unquote friendships through the internet with people we don't meet, people we don't know, and with whom we communicate merely by typing back and forth, what we're finding out is that this is leading to social alienation, a decrease in the development of healthy social skills. It seems to feed into depression in some children and adolescents.
Healthy skills means that people actually communicate, talk to one another.
Right. People tend to do better and to develop skills of relating by interacting face-to-face with verbal speech at so many different strata, from the neurological to the psychological, that when you're engaged with someone, you're looking at facial expressions, you're listening to nuance of voice, you're using hand gestures, which is something that Semites tend to do anyway. Those are all missing when you're limited to the keyboard and to the computer screen. So the ability to bond, the ability to get to know people in a way that you can develop empathy and consideration for others, that's gone. Not to mention the fact that when we've started using note hand or shorthand to substitute for our expression of emotion, for example, the ubiquitous LOL for laugh out loud. So a child or an adolescent, even adult, may rush to type those three letters when someone has sent them something that's amusing or that's touching. And yet, zipping into typing letters is sidestepping and really short-circuiting a very important affective experience in people. So when I type LOL, but I'm not actually laughing, and I'm not letting my feelings out, and I'm really letting my fingers do the talking, but I'm circumventing my ability to process something and to feel it. So what seems to be taking place is people are being reconditioned to downplay emotion. And there are a lot of implications for that in terms of the development of mood disorder, the development of hyperactivity, diminution of attention, and other really negative psychological outcomes.
We're going to probably see more of that as the younger children become, they're so skilled at using these the internet and technology that by the time they come to school, they're proficient.
Yeah, the younger the child is when they are being pushed to develop this as an alternative mode of communicating, the more we're seeing that the brain actually rewires itself, which is very frightening. We don't yet know all of the ramifications of that, but when we're looking at what's going on in terms of traditional input, throughput, and output to the brain using all five of the senses, and when we are limiting so much of that to the hand and the eye and the computer monitor, we're actually seeing evidence that attention, concentration, and memory circuits seem to dry up in the brain, or at least they don't develop normally. And the ramifications for that 5, 10, and 15 years later are that people don't remember things, people don't need to remember things, and our memory is something that becomes external.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So what do you suggest that, parents do? I mean, you have to allow them a certain amount of time. I guess in anything in excess of whatever, that's when the problems could start.
Yeah, well, it is a challenge. If we go back into the annals of the early philosophers, Socrates was actually outspokenly opposed to people learning how to write. He felt that writing things down, rather than people storing them in the memory, would lead to a decrease in cerebral output. So if we look back in history, there has always been an aversion to technology. There have been traditionalists who say that you should avoid it and it's going to minimize the human experience. On the other hand, you can't fight it. There are certainly necessary advances in the use of technology, just like writing is something that we've done and there are benefits to it. There are manifold benefits to the healthy use and the appropriate use of technology. What I think what we need to watch out for in raising Jewish children is that the computer doesn't become a virtual parent, a virtual babysitter, and even a virtual teacher, which means that we have to not only set time limits on how much youngsters are exposed to internet and to the computer as a substitute for other learning modalities, but we also have to filter and screen what we're exposing them to. And I'm not speaking about decadent exposure. I'm even speaking about objective lessons and things to read and games to play and puzzles and all of the challenges which can stimulate certain parts of the brain. But if it's at the expense of allowing a child methodically and gradually to develop other neuropsychological skills, we've really got to monitor what we're doing.
So, how does it differ from, let's say, the generation back when kids would sit in front of the TV for endless amount of hours? Now they're sitting in front of the computer screen. So what's the difference between the two?
Okay, there's a very big difference neuropsychologically, which means how the experience affects the wiring in the brain. And I think the two detrimental elements or the two pitfalls of a lot of television exposure proved to be the lack of creativity, the fact that the TV sort of lulled someone into a diminished level of consciousness, so the brain is not active. So that was one of the difficulties of excessive TV exposure. And then, of course, the second was that fantasy, technicolor, was beginning to mold and to shape the types of things that kids would think about. And in the Jewish home, we have to be careful about that. Those are the two things with television. Now, the internet, excessive computer use, seems to be doing something different than shutting down the mind. What it's doing is sort of, it's almost the opposite, but not in a positive way. It's overstimulating the mind. Kids are learning to multitask. Working on the computer, it seems to take the same toll as someone gave this example of trying to read a novel while doing a crossword puzzle at the same time, which means that you're rapidly stimulating many, many different areas of the brain and conflicting areas of the brain, so that you've got a cerebral overload. Kids are trying to do too much at once. There's the attention span that's needed in order to keep track of what's going on the computer is about 4 seconds, because about every 4 seconds, new lights, new colors, new images are coming on. So a child is working hard to maintain control over that visual field, and what happens is the child's getting overstimulated to the degree that he won't develop, he or she won't develop the ability to sustain focus, to concentrate, to, for example, when the computer screen is shut off, that child's not going to have the ability to sit back, reflect, and process information.
So what is a parent supposed to do? In other words, you know, technology is here. You know, I mean, once again, we'll talk about that. Maybe there are certain segments within the Orthodox Jewish community that still feel they could isolate, their constituent base away from technology and not bring it into the home at all. I'm not sure if you agree with that, but for the vast majority of people, it's going to be there. So what's the right mix? What do you do?
Well, let me respond with two things. Firstly, the first one's kind of funny, but the last 6 years I have had the merit to sit on the Rabbeinu Jerusalem Beit HaDin. And I have on my BlackBerry, yes, I confess I have a BlackBerry, but I have my BlackBerry photographs, about a half dozen pictures of the computers which each Dayan is given. So every Dayan, whether he's a Hasid and a European, or whether he's a Sephardi, or whether he's a person with a Kippah Sruga, each Dayan on the Beit HaDin, in the room where we hear Diyunim, has a computer screen in front of him. And so this has made its way with, a sincere spiritual and halachic application. So we can't avoid it. It's showing up in all circles, and there is an appropriate use of technology. But it's a funny photo I've got. You've got three elderly Dayanim, all of whom are busy on Google looking up Tshuvot in order to render an appropriate halachic decision. So it's in there, we're going to use it, and holy people and good people are making use of technology, and we have to figure out how
we can
do that.
So you don't think is there a wide approach, like on the part of many, let's say, Haredi, Hasidic sects that are trying to just create the world in which this still doesn't exist?
I'm sure there are minority elements who shun many of the advances, but you can go into the back room of a mocher tefillin in Mea Shearim, and they're going to be keeping track of their sales on the internet or on the computer. So whether we're using it openly, whether we're using it in a very limited way, l'shem shemayim, or for business or parnas or whatever we say, it's ubiquitous, and I don't think we can avoid it. But we need to monitor what we're doing. As far as your original question, what about parents? I think the remedy or the antidote for excessive computer use, besides setting limits with our kids, is parents have to go back to talking to their children. Parents have to be the primary figure in shaping the values of their kids. And in that, computer use does not allow a child to do reflection and introspection and careful processing of what they're learning. This is where the parent can be most valuable. This is where the teacher, this is where the rabbi can be most valuable. Encouraging children to formulate their own opinions, getting children to talk about how they feel about something. if you just inundate a young mind with data, with bytes and bits of data, and the child doesn't have a chance to think it through, you really end up indoctrinating a child subtly. And that's another example of what I call the closed encounter. The child's mind is not being open.
And so do you think that we should be changing the curriculum? I mean, the curriculum was developed a long time ago. Now we have a new phenomena. Change it, adapt to what's going on. But, I mean, I think it's parents, teachers. We've got to create this communication that it's important for the memory, it's important for the interpersonal skills, et cetera, right?
The last part, what you said, I agreed with. The first part I didn't follow when you say, should we change the curriculum?
In other words, because of the fact that today you'll go into a school, and even in the kindergarten or in first grade, they'll be using computers much more than they ever did before. This is going to take away from the social development of the kids, their ability to communicate, to speak, interact, and so on. So schools have to adapt to that and start to change some things in order to make sure we don't lose those skills.
Correct. In other words, going back a little bit to the more basic, old-fashioned approach of human education.
Right.
I do strongly believe that. I'm an advocate of that. And I would also suggest that, and I think I mentioned this in my article in my interview with Jewish Action, that I'm not convinced that anyone, for example, who looks at a PowerPoint that is intended to expose them to something religious or spiritual, I'm not convinced that anyone watches that and actually walks away feeling religiously inspired. I think it's just saturating the mind with images and with colors and with music, which does something, it stimulates something, but without the ability to think about and reflect and talk about what the experience has been, I believe that a lot of that information gets relegated to a storage bin someplace inside remote memory, and it eventually disintegrates.
Okay. And know that also that you were answered some questions about Derech Eretz, and basically it seemed to me what you were saying is that it's up to the parents to set the example. And you know, you could read about maybe great stories of great rabbis, but it's what the kid sees at home, and that's how they're going to learn whether you know what Derech Eretz is all about.
Example is a much better model than reading a vignette. Seeing something in vivo and being able to look at someone applying a value is far more useful to a child or even to an adult than hearing a sermon about it or reading something about it in a magazine or even in a paper.
Do you think that Orthodox Jewish people in general have more respect, more Derech Eretz than, let's say, a non-observant Jew or even a non-Jew?
It's a tough question. What I find in my dealings with various ethnicities and various strata within the Jewish world, religious and non-religious, is that there is frequently an emphasis on humanism, on interpersonal ethics, many religious or many subsets of religions focus on it. I will even cautiously say it becomes a substitute for mitzvot. So in other words, whereas we are ideally involved in caring about other Jews and caring about other people and also serving God, in a humanistic religion, there very often is a very strong emphasis, maybe an exclusive emphasis, on ethics and on what we'll loosely call Derech Eretz. And that's something that we in the religious Jewish world have to think about, because we may learn about Derech Eretz and we may hear Shiurim about it, and we may learn Pirkei Avot, and we may study Musar and things like that, but we don't seem to put quite as much emphasis on instilling a strong commitment to caring about people. But we can do it academically, and we can do it with our lumdus, and we have sort of parallel ways of looking at their parents, but I think we can learn from other groups who do seem to emphasize morality.
Really? Like who?
Well, I'll tell you something. When I was in Yerushalayim a month and a half ago, I took a picture of something that stirred me. It was a picture of an archway at night leading into the old city. And experimentally, I sent it to a number of my colleagues. I sent the photo, said, what do you think of this? And my Orthodox colleagues, most of them responded at a very intellectual level, talking about the architecture. They wanted to know where it was, exactly what street was they on. And it was a Catholic colleague of mine, Catholic colleague of mine, who responded and said, that is such a spiritual image.
Really?
Okay, so now, that makes us stop and think with all of our cerebral approach to practicing Orthodoxy, and that's important, and that is a part of being a learned Jew is definitely a part of being a spiritual person. But what are we doing to help our kids talk about their neshama? What are we doing to help our kids reflect? What are we doing to help our kids or train our kids to the importance of getting a sensitivity to the world around them? And that's something that we need to work on better.
Well, don't you think that that's the reason you're seeing, like even within the Orthodox world, you're seeing people trying to find the spirituality that the intellectual pursuit alone, very difficult to find real spirituality. You need a combination of the spiritual and then, of course, knowledge-based and intellectual Judaism to reach that point. But I see people today desperately trying to find, you know, some connection, the neshama trying to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and yet sometimes I just don't get it from doing a Marsha and Bava Kamma.
I don't at all disagree with you. There's an old joke we tell in the yeshiva world about the question is, why does a brisker believe in God? And the answer is because the Rambam says to and the Ra'avad does not disagree.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Right. Okay. That's the point. That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. So what do you see as the challenges? Okay. So now Orthodox Jewry, we've grown, we've prospered despite what people thought 50 years ago. What do you see as the two or three major challenges that are going to confront Orthodox Jews in the next decade that we have to be careful about?
It's a question that I wish I could reflect on rather than give you a knee-jerk response, but I'll try to give you a knee-jerk. So you want three thoughts from me about what are the challenges or the hurdles we're going to have to cross in the years to come?
Right.
Okay. So off the cuff, I would first offer that we're going to have to look at the tension, the dialectic between having become affluent and entitled versus the growing costs of remaining Orthodox, the financial costs. So I think this is a challenge that we have become wealthy, we have become affluent. With that comes a degree of entitlement and arrogance. And yet we have a generation who's going to follow us, who turns to us for financial support, and we're running out of money. And what are we doing to prepare our kids for the future, not only fiscally, but attitudinally as well? I think that's a challenge.
I think that's an excellent point. Fantastic. I agree with you about that 100%.
Great.
That's pretty good. Pretty good from off the cuff, Dr. Fox. Not bad.
Well, thanks. Did I venture with my other two?
Why not? So far, you're batting 1,000, okay?
Okay, great. Another thing, we had touched upon it, it's the growing quest for spirituality. I think we need definitions of what's spiritual, and we need to get back as Orthodox observant Jews to our spiritual roots. It's not part of what we talk about. It's not something that we expose our children to. When someone asks you how you are and you say Baruch Hashem, there's nothing spiritual about that. When you stop and you reflect and you say, I'm grateful to God, you say it in the lingua franca, you say it in jargon that you understand, and it moves you, and it becomes a spiritual moment for you, people look at you like you're weird or you're Christian. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to rethink and work on acquainting ourselves to what makes us unique as human beings, which is having a spirit or having a soul. And that needs to become part of our conscious thinking. And it's been a long time since we Jews look at ourselves or look at our religious leaders and say, we are a pious people, or we have righteous leaders, or we have saintly persons among us. We don't think in those terms. Mm-hmm. And there are other religions where those terms are still applied. We don't talk about ourselves that way. We don't talk about our Rabbanim that way. And we have to figure out why that's no longer part of our conceptual internal monologue and how to reinstill that.
Okay, great. I agree with you. I agree with you. So let's do the last one since we're
on the last one, okay? Quickly, I think that we have to develop a sense of community. We're getting busier and busier with things. We said earlier we're friending each other on Facebook, although I don't have a Facebook account myself. But we are expanding ourselves in inconsequential. And we have to find a way to connect with people at a people level so that we can start re-invoking Ahavat Reyim and Kol Yisrael Arevim and all of these principles which make the Jewish people cohesive. I think we've neglected them. And we have to care for each other so that there's no stoning in Ramat Beit Shemesh and there's no spitting on the streets of this community and
right.
shunning
right.
each
right.
other. And
I guess it's a question of also the word tolerance and somehow that word is missing from our vocabulary. And unless somebody is exactly like us, behaves like us, acts like us, thinks like us, then, you know, it could be that, you know, they're not the kind of person you want to associate with. So these are very interesting things, Dr. Fox. It has been an absolute pleasure to spend the last half hour with you, and we've we've gone from technology to Derech Eretz to the Jewish people, and I encourage all of our listeners to read the article that Dr. Fox participated in, and look forward to speaking to you again and your insights into the world and what's going on. Hopefully people who are listening will take heart, and it's time to think about what we're going to do about communication, about Derech Eretz, about spirituality. And I appreciate your coming on the program this morning, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be well. Bye-bye.